Now, though we've used the expression reflection, which is a bit static, we are not to think of the bodhicitta in purely static terms. What is known in the Mahayana tradition as the absolute bodhicitta, the bodhicitta in its absolute aspect, outside space and time, this absolute bodhicitta is identical with reality itself. And being identical with reality, the absolute bodhicitta is as such beyond change. Or rather, we may say it's beyond the opposition between change and non-change. But this doesn't hold good of what is known to the tradition as the relative bodhicitta. The relative bodhicitta is, as it were, an active force. An active force at work. And this is why, as I said a little while ago, I prefer personally, if I have to translate the term bodhicitta, to speak of it as the will to enlightenment. Bearing in mind that one is speaking, of course, of the relative, as distinct from the absolute bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment. But this will to enlightenment is not an act of will of any individual. The bodhicitta is not something which I will. Just as it's not my thought, it's not my will. The bodhicitta is no more an act of anybody's individual will than it is anybody's individual thought. We might, in fact, though here we have rather to grope for words, we might, in fact, think of the bodhicitta as a sort of cosmic will. I don't quite like to use this word will, but there's really no other. A sort of cosmic will, if you like, a will at work in the world, at work in the universe, in the direction of what we can only think of as universal redemption, the liberation, the enlightenment, ultimately, of all sentient beings. We may even think of the bodhicitta as a sort of spirit of enlightenment, immanent in the world and leading individuals to higher and ever higher degrees of spiritual perfection. So this being the case, it's clear that individuals do not possess the bodhicitta. If you possess it, it's not the bodhicitta. It's something else. It's your own thought. It's your own idea. But the bodhicitta, the transcendental, non-individual, cosmic bodhicitta, you've missed. You've got hold of something else. Individuals do not possess the bodhicitta. We may say that it's the bodhicitta that possesses individuals. And those of whom the bodhicitta takes possession, as it were, in whom this bodhicitta arises, or within whom it manifests, become what we call bodhisattvas. They live, that is to say, for the sake of enlightenment. They strive to actualize, for the benefit of all, the highest potentialities that the universe contains. So much then for the bodhicitta. Very much more could be said about it. Some of the Mahayana sutras in particular are never tired of singing the praises of the bodhicitta. I remember that a few years ago when I was in Kalimpong, I was compiling a book on Buddhist canonical literature. The whole field of Buddhist canonical literature. And I came, amongst other things, to the Mahayana sutras, and among other sutras, to the Gandavyuha. And I wanted to quote just a few verses of what the Gandavyuha said in one place about the bodhicitta. And believe it or not, there were hundreds and hundreds of clauses and hundreds of illustrations comparing the bodhicitta to this, comparing it to that, comparing it to a gold mine, comparing it to the sun, comparing it to the moon, comparing it to everything. And you got the impression, after going through this vast array of similes and comparisons, that the bodhicitta for the Mahayana author, traditionally of course the Buddha of the sutra, the bodhicitta was just everything. It was hymned and it was praised, almost as though it had been a sort of deity. You certainly didn't get the impression of someone's thought or someone's idea, but something vast, something cosmic, something sublime, which descends into and penetrates and possesses people who are receptive to it. Not anything individual, not anything limited in any way. So the Mahayana sutras, not only the Gandavyuha, but many other sutras, sing the praises of the bodhicitta inexhaustibly.